Welcome to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. On the show today, the author of a new book that catalogues, for the first time ever, the coals and passes of the British Isles. And that's all of them, all 2,002 of them. His name is Graham Robb. He's a former fellow of Exeter College, Oxford, an acclaimed biographer and historian. He's also a touring cyclist and joins me on a phone line from his home in the English-Scottish borders. Welcome to The Bike Show, Graham. Many people listening will know you as the author of The Discovery of France, which was published back in 2007. And so before moving on to talk about your latest book about coals and passes, perhaps we can talk for a moment about that book, because it's really one of my favourite books, and it's a book that I'm always recommending to anyone who'll listen to me, and particularly to people who follow the Tour de France and want to get to grips with the history of France and how modern France invented itself, because that's really the subject that you are trying to uncover in that book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it was supposed to be a book about France rather than a book about Paris, in which France just fills in the bits of social history, because most histories of France are really histories of Paris. And actually, France is really the empire of Paris. It was the country that was created as a suburb of Paris. As I'm sure you know, everything is still very centred on Paris, transport as well as culture.
And so you went out on your bicycle to discover France for yourself over, I assume, many years. Well, it was the ideal way to do it, right?
It was really the other way about. I still do cycle a lot in France. And the book simply came about because it was a book I couldn't find anywhere. As you cycle through France, of course, you see lots of things that car driver won't see. And I always had the feeling that I was missing something. I wanted to make sure that I knew what it was I was seeing when I went through all these tiny little places. So I used to just put, wasn't quite pre-computer days, but there wasn't any convenient way of carrying information. So I just printed out all the information I could find about these tiny little places on very thin sheets of paper, double-sided. And as I went through France, I'd throw away the pieces of paper as I went through each place. So the idea was the luggage would get lighter rather than heavier. And eventually it dawned on me that someone else might find this interesting too. So that's how the book came about. But it wouldn't have been written without the bicycle. And once I decided to write it, I then realized how crucial the bicycle is as a kind of time machine. It's the best historical research vehicle that there is. And of course, it also means it's great fun. And it should be fun if you're writing a book, because readers can always tell if you're not enjoying it.
And there's a section at the beginning of that book that I just want to read out, actually, because I think it's just so good. And it goes as follows. Cycling not only makes it possible to conduct exhaustive research into local produce, it also creates an enormous appetite for information. Certain configurations of field, road, weather, and smell imprint themselves on the cycling brain with inexplicable clarity and return sometimes years later to pose their nebulous questions. A bicycle unrolls a 360-degree panorama of the land and allows the rider to register its gradual changes in gear ratios and muscle tension, and makes it hard to miss a single inch of it, from the tire-lacerating suburbs of Paris to the Mistral-blasted plains of Provence. The itinerary of a cyclist recreates, as if by chance, much older journeys, transhumance trails, Gallo-Roman trade routes, pilgrim paths, river confluences that have disappeared in an industrial wasteland, valleys and ridge roads that used to be busy with peddlers and migrants. Cycling also makes conversation easy and inevitable with children, nomads, people who are lost, local amateur historians, and of course, dogs, whose behaviour collectively characterises the outlook of certain regions as clearly as human behaviour once did. If having read that or heard that, and you don't want to get on your bike and go cycle touring, I just don't know what's the matter with you, to be honest.
So actually, the funny thing about Discovery of France is that a lot of people who've read it have said to me, we've driven through France with Cook. And I thought I didn't make it clear enough. But there's something very abstract about car travel. So that someone, for example, told me they'd been to one of the presumed centres of France, and there are lots of little tiny corners of the Bourbonnais in the centre of France, which at various times have been said to be the exact point that's the middle of France. And it turned out they'd just gone down the motorway and seen a sign on the gantry saying you are at the centre of France, which isn't at all the same thing. I think people don't realise how easy it is to cycle, and that they shouldn't try to go faster than their body wants them to go, because all you have to do is pedal hard enough to keep the bike upright, which is just walking speed. And then if you're comfortable, you can go a little bit faster. And probably the reason that in most parts of France it's easier to cycle than it is in this country is there's a real warmth towards cyclists, and there's a feeling that you're discovering this lovely country in the way in which it should be discovered. Drivers behave very differently, and you generally get quite a warm welcome, and you get well fed in restaurants. And if you want to talk to the natives, you can forget about all the usual phrases that you get in phrase books. You just need to know things like triple plateau for a triple chain ring, and you know, look up French for brake blocks, and you get a real appreciation of the machine you're riding as well.
Do you enjoy watching the Tour de France? It's on right now. Do you enjoy the spectacle? Do you enjoy looking at the landscape?
Yes, enormously. And actually, it used to be very, very useful if you're planning a route before Google Earth and Google Street View and all that, just to see what kind of road you were going to be riding on. And the great thing about Tour de France is they do use big roads, but they also use surprisingly tiny little country roads. And it still is a really good way to do the research.
And the Tour does play a special part in French identity. I mean, that's, I suppose, why it was created. And it still serves that function, even though it doesn't make the great circuit around the landmass anymore. And they take trains and fly from the Alpe d'Huez on the last day into Paris and things like that. That sort of actual Tour of France has ended. But still, the Tour is part of France.
It is, yes. And it started up at a time when there was a very deliberate effort to bring the different parts of France together. The parts of France which did still consider themselves to be distinct regions and whose dialects or languages were quite different from the language that was spoken in Paris. And at the time, Tour de France, in most people's minds, meant the tour that was undertaken by young apprentices. You would leave whichever town you'd grown up in with your trade and go on a particular route all the way around France and stay for a few weeks or months with a master in his trade in a particular town. It was very well organized, and there were hostels. In fact, still are. You do still see some young people doing their Tour de France. So Tour de France referred to this apprentice's discovery of the whole country. And it is still seen in that way, as you say. It's supposed to be an annual rediscovery of the land. And I think one thing that surprises some foreign fans of the Tour de France who go over there, Americans and Australians, is that there's very little nationalistic component to it, that the vast majority of people who are out there waiting for the riders to go by couldn't care less who wins. They'll cheer almost anyone. And of course, they aren't really, they're the silent majority. It's really just a pleasant spectacle. And it's the sort of thing you're supposed to have seen when you were a child. You know, my granddad held me on his shoulders when I saw the Tour de France go by.
We do need things now more than ever for building bridges between the generations, because it does feel as though our societies are fracturing on a sort of intergenerational term. So that's interesting that it should play that role.
And it's interesting to see the Tour of Britain beginning to play a similar role. And round here, actually, right on the border, there's a very small population, it's very scattered. But even at lonely road junctions in what appears to be the middle of nowhere, you do get quite large groups of people coming out to see the Tour of Britain go past. And actually, they're very good bike race spectators, because a lot of them are sheep farmers. And I remember seeing Tour of Britain go through 2 or 3 years ago, and it was coming from Newcastle to Scottish borders, very, very late, because they were going against a gale. I've never seen professional cyclists go so slowly. And sheep farmers were fine. There was this crowd of people standing in the rain without umbrellas, patiently waiting for half an hour for the wretched cyclists to come past. It would be great if the Tour of Britain starts to perform the same function here.
That would be good. Well, it's a lot of history to accrue before that happens. But let's wish them all the best. A few years after the discovery of France, you wrote The Ancient Paths, Discovering the Lost Map of Celtic Europe, which is a history book in a completely different vein, really, 2,000 or more years before most of the events of the discovery of France, although much of the action takes place in the same territory. Back then it was, or we referred to it back then as Gaul, where Celtic tribes lived. And the book attempts to overturn some of the most firmly held conventional wisdom in our kind of collective consciousness about history, such as that it was the Romans that gave us the straight roads. And again, the bicycle was a crucial research tool for you. Tell me a bit more about the genesis and the writing of that book.
It was an attempt to explore the mathematical basis of Celtic art and towns and roads. They were very good at mathematics because a lot of their culture came not from Rome but from Greece. And we already knew that a lot of their temples or shrines were built on a very particular axis, which relates to the sun of the solstice, which, if you don't have compasses and GPS units, is a more useful guide than the North Pole, because there was no star at the North Pole 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So I wanted to show what was already well known to the Romans, that the Celtic civilization was a very sophisticated civilization. And the Celts had occupied all of northern Italy when Rome was just a small town on the river Tiber. And the Romans were so impressed by the technology of this superior civilization that they just adopted it. They had nothing, the chariots, the carts, the carriages, all the vehicles that the Celts had were far, far more sophisticated than that the Romans had, which is why every word in Latin for a wheeled vehicle comes from Celtic. And actually, talking of bicycles as we are, these chariots, which have the most precise gearing and wide-angled steering, I thought, as a thought experiment, could the ancient Celts have invented the bicycle? And of course, it's impossible to answer because we haven't yet found an ancient Celtic bicycle. But if someone had given them the idea, it's quite clear they would have been able to produce practically all the components. Obviously not carbon frames, but they could have made chains, they could have made cables, they could have made wheels. You know, they made beautiful wheels. Even writing that book, it was very useful having the bicycle. But also, because roads were so important, simply cycling up to Celtic hill forts gives you an unforgettable idea of what it actually meant to live on top of a hill fort. And my constant companion, my wife Margaret, I think this is her least favourite book actually, because the steeper the road, usually the older it is. And since we were going back 2,000 years, we had some horrendous climbs.
So you did a lot of miles for this book as well. The Discovery of France, you did something like five times the length of the Tour de France over a number of years.
Was it that way?
Something like that, I think.
But the key thing is to go slowly. The other good thing about riding with someone who isn't a boy is they're not always trying to go faster. And that's why we were able to go on very, very long journeys, because otherwise, if I'd cycled like a boy. I would have messed my knees up after a week, and I wouldn't have been able to keep it up for 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So I think that was the key. But actually, Celtic Book was great fun to research, because very often the towns we now live in are Roman, whereas the Celtic towns are often outside the town and are deserted. So it does take you to quite remote places that you wouldn't have gone to otherwise.
It reminds me of something that I always feel that when I'm doing my own research for my guidebooks, that with a bicycle you can stop anywhere you want at very low cost of inconvenience. You don't have to park. If you want to look and climb over a hedge to get a certain view of a certain aspect of the landscape and see if that alignment of that hedgerow and that road is suggesting something to you, it's not difficult to do it. In a car, you just think, well, look, should I really stop? Because it's going to cause the traffic to get backed up. I'm going to have to park down the lane and walk back up again. On a bicycle, not only are you immersed in it a lot more closely, but you can get off and sort of wander about. And it's just so much easier to see things. And both of the books we're talking about and the one we'll come on to talk about just glitter with detail. And I believe it's the kind of detail that you're obviously a very accomplished historian and very deeply read and a great researcher. But getting out there onto the ground, what you're talking about, and seeing the places, there's no substitute for that, is there?
No, there isn't. You're right. There are all the things that you notice that you weren't looking for at all. And as you say, it's so easy to stop. And it's difficult to make yourself stop, isn't it? Because you're going somewhere, you have to get there. But of course, you do have to stop. And if I were teaching history undergraduates, I'd definitely take them out on a very long bike ride. You could just spend half the term doing it. And people would make all sorts of interesting historical discoveries just by having to stop for what they call a natural break on the Tour de France.
So on to Coles and Passes of the British Isles, which was published last month, and it's a beautiful book, hardback edition, a nice tall book, and it's essentially a very, very, very long list of all the Coles and Passes of the British Isles, with a little bit of information about them, location, and then some curation at the front by you, Graham, about some of your favourite ones and most interesting ones. Before we get into that, what is a col and what is a pass, and are they not the same thing?
Well, every col is a pass, but not every pass is a col. Because col has a very precise geological definition. It's a gap or a depression or any kind of cleavage between hills or in a range of hills, which is usually formed either by seismic activity or the action of glaciers, and then it's gradually eroded into a cradle or a saddle and provides the easiest route over the ridge or the range of hills. So one way to describe it is that you're looking at two intersecting arcs. So you can either cross a col by going up to it and then down on the other side, or if you're walking along the ridge, you would first go down into it and then up out of it on the other side. And actually, they're quite rare. I mean, the 2002, but that's the whole British Isles. More than half of them are in Scotland, but there are groups of cols in other parts of Britain. Whereas a pass is a much more general term. It's just any kind, it very often just refers to the road or the track that goes up over the mountains, but it doesn't necessarily come to an actual col in the geological, geographical sense. But I wanted to include all the places that are known as passes in the catalogue, indicating their distinct status. Simply because people would expect to find them in there, and they're similar to cols, but without that precise definition.
And so, what made you decide to go col hunting And how many did you think you'd find when you began?
I had no idea. I didn't think it would be quite as many as 2002. And I think my publisher, Penguin Particular Books, became a bit anxious at one point when the total seemed to be increasing every week. And 2002, it was just quite by chance, but it's quite nice that 2002 looks a little bit like a drawing of a bicycle. Beside the point. I couldn't at first work out why there was no such thing, because Coles are well known to cyclists and used by cyclists, loved by cyclists. I kept looking for this book, which I wanted to own, and couldn't find it, and so I just started making a list of Coles in my local area, which is another story, really. And then I realized, well, this will just have to be, I'll have to write the book so I can then go and buy it. And after I worked on it for 2 months and realized the size of the task, I then understood why no one had written the book, because then I realized it was going to take a very long time. But once you've worked on something for 2 months, it's very hard to abandon it, because the 2 months will be wasted. And you can just see glimmering in the far, far distance the completion of the project. So you just have to keep going at that point.
So just to get it clear in my mind, does a coal have to have a path going over it? Does it have to have a kind of a right of way or a track or something like that? Or can it just be a sheer geological situation?
Yes, it can just be. It's primarily a geological feature. But because the coal provides the easiest way from one valley to the next, they very often do have paths or tracks or roads, sometimes even motorways, going over them. So it's primarily geological. But what makes them particularly interesting and not just useful is that because they were used, they tend to be little nodal points of British history, because they were used over the years by migrants and pilgrims and armies and fugitives and farmers and so on, and drovers. So it's partly geography, but it's mainly human geography.
And that, I guess, comes through in the fact that most of them have names. Is that right?
Yes, most of them do have names.
And was it hard to dig those names up? Because they're not all there on the, you know, on the Ordnance Survey map, are they? I wouldn't imagine.
No, they're not all there. And actually, a lot of them have fallen off the Ordnance Survey map, because once we started travelling around by car, they became much less important, because you just push the accelerator pedal and obliterate the hill, in effect. So there was a lot of looking at all the old maps I could find, but also any account of the region in question where someone had recorded the name of the coal. And eventually, I think I was able to find the majority of them, but there are a lot of coals which are anonymous.
The book opens with a few pages of different words that are used for these features. As someone who's recently moved to Wales and trying to very slowly get to grips with the Welsh language, the variety of landscape terms and the fact that there are landscape terms that don't necessarily have a corresponding term in English is something that is opening up the landscape and making me regard it in a different way, which I'm finding quite an interesting process.
That was one of the most fascinating things about writing this book. And when I first started putting a list together, I realised that, you know, once you've gone over coals that you know to be coals because there was a sign there, because it was in France, you start to recognise their features and types. And I'd think, I'm sure this is a coal, but I couldn't find anything on the map. And then, as I looked at older maps, I'd start to see these words that I was completely unfamiliar with, like Hass and Swire, and Nick, which is slightly more obvious, or doors or stairs. And I realised that this, often their names are still there on the map. It's just that we no longer recognise them as the names of coals. So that was particularly engrossing. I mean, the list ended up being a little, like a tiny dictionary, with 138 different terms in all. And the nice thing about them is that they tended to be used in a very precise sense, so that in the Scottish West Highlands, for example, there are a few calls called Fiadan, Fadcan, which means whistle or the chanter of a bagpipe. And all those calls are very narrow, and wind whistles through them. Then you know, ah yes, that's going to be a particular kind of call. Whereas another word, Unyag, which means window, is applied to very broad calls, which give you a magnificent view when you get up to the top. It's like suddenly opening a window and seeing a new world on the other side.
And so presumably what you'd love people to do with this book is to sort of start going coal bagging. And it's already something that cyclists like to do, because some of the coals in the book are famous cycling road climbs or famous off-road routes. Near me, there's the Gospel Pass up above Hay on Wye, and then there's the Gap beneath Penavan, which is a celebrated mountain biking route. It's an interesting book, but it's also very practical. People can go out and visit these places.
Yes, there's certainly real challenges there. I mean, you could do all, what is it, about 430-something road coals. Lots of other coals that are on a track. When I wanted to go and buy this book and realised it didn't exist, I was wanting a book that would just enable me to add a bit of interest to a long bike ride. And just, it gives you a target, and it tends to make you stop, because you think, here I am at the coal, and I could feel myself turning into a pedant and a bore once I started writing the book, because I'd cycle over a coal, and you'd see a cyclist coming in the opposite direction, I'd say, I would stop him and say, do you realise you're crossing Cark and Nick? But I think, you know, it's good for that. It brings life to certain parts of the landscape that you might otherwise just have whizzed past.
And have you got a few favourites that you'd recommend to people to go by bike?
Well, there's a lovely coal just below Shap, which is the big pass to the east of the Lake District, which is really it's where the English-Scottish border ought to be, really. Once you've crossed Shap, you feel that you're practically in Scotland and on the other side. Now, Shap itself is a pass. It's just a road that goes up onto the high moors, goes along a plateau and drops down the other side. And I was looking at maps to see if I could find old maps of Shap. And there's one map produced by a man who was charting the turnpike system. And it was the very end of the 17th century. And just before Shap, he had a little house. And next to it said Horse House. I thought, that's odd, because he had it at the top of a climb. And if there was a house for horses where you changed the post horses, it wouldn't have been at the top, it would have been at the foot of the climb. I eventually realized house is house, as they pronounce it in these parts, which is the same as has. And it's a word for coal. In fact, it's the same word as coal. It comes from the Old Norse house for neck. So he must have asked someone locally, said, what's this part of the road called? And the person said, Horse House. He thought, Horse House, and drew his little house on the map. But it's the name of a coal, and it's quite a subtle coal, because when you're cycling up there, you're obviously just thinking about reaching the summit of Shap. But once you know it's there, you have a fantastic view on both sides. But you have to stop in order to see the coal. And once you do, the landscape starts to fall into place, as it were. And it's nice that it now has a name. I'd recommend it to cyclists, because it's on the old A road, which has been replaced by the motorway. It's a fantastic road. And as usual, cars always get the best gradients. So it's not too bad at all going up. There's a lovely long descent on the other side and almost no traffic. And a nice wide road.
Terrific. Well, thanks for that recommendation. Quite right. Well, are you working on another book, and is it got a bicycle research element you can tell us about?
It wasn't going to, but the bicycles crept into it. It's about where I live at the moment. It's about a little country that used to exist between England and Scotland. And once again, cycling has been invaluable. But I don't have a car anyway, so I have to use the bike for shopping and transport and everything else. And it has been great for research because, as I'm sure you know, in this country, people tend to assume that cyclists are going quite slowly, and so they don't mind hailing them and stopping them. So it's been great around here because if you cycle, it's like being famous because everyone in the area knows you. You think, oh, it's those people who cycle. And, of course, they can see your face, and you can't see their face because it's behind a windscreen. So cycling's been quite important, and also for because it's about partly about the Middle Ages as well as about the present, it does mean that you're travelling along the same speed as a horse-drawn vehicle, usually.
Well, that helps, doesn't it, to get into that mindset?
It does help. You're seeing that the landscape unfolding itself at the same speed as it would have done in the Middle Ages.
Terrific. Well, a time machine as well. Brilliant. Well, Graham, Rob, thank you very much for joining me on The Bike Show. Coles and Passes of the British Isles is published by Particular Books, and the other books are also very much still in print, so look them out. I'll put details of them all on The Bike Show website. Graham, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You know, as I get to invite people onto the show, it's rare that I invite someone that I don't like to talk, but you are a genuine hero of mine, and it's terrific to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was great.
Thanks for downloading and listening to this edition of The Bike Show. I'm sorry about the rather scratchy quality of the audio. That's the best we can do on a phone line, and phone was the only way I was able to reach Graham at his home in the English-Scottish borders. I'm hoping he'll come on the show again, maybe next time in a rolling interview. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Next time on The Bike Show, we'll be looking in some detail at one of the great multi-day bike routes in the British Isles, and that's the Devon Coast to Coast, so tune in for that. Until then, from me, Jack Thurston, thanks for listening, and goodbye.